You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 23rd, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Graham Raymond, criminal justice reporter for the New York Daily News, and Reuven Blau, senior reporter for the city, authors of Rikers, an oral history. Also on the program today, mass shooter kills 10 and himself in a Monterey Park, California. Meanwhile, former New York FBI agent in charge of counterterrorism charged with money laundering with Russia. Ron Klain to step down. New chief of staff will be a corporate clown. Fed contemplates slowing its assault on workers. Janet Yellen rejects minting a trillion-dollar coin to avoid the debt ceiling fiasco. FBI finds six more documents in Biden's home. Supreme Court investigator issues a release saying she only interacted with the Supreme Court justices in her failed investigation. USN's federal free school lunch program choosing again to further immiserate low-income children. Iowa Republicans want to ban SNAP recipients from buying meat, white bread, and cheese, or flour. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Beginning of a new week. We are all aglow, having been at the big Give Them a Revolution Left Reckoning show last night.
Yep.
Matt is surprisingly here with us. And, of course, Emma is here as well.
Yeah.
And also not a little bit of a surprise, based upon things got a little bit out of hand. At the show last night.
A little tiny bit, yeah.
Yep.
Well, everyone was very kind to buy us drinks. We're feeling that kindness today.
Yep. And to bring whiskey.
Yep. There was a lot of that going around. Fun time had by all. It was great to see a bunch of Majority Report listeners and viewers there. Met Kowalski for the first time.
Yep.
Who else was there from
Marcus from a Left Flank Vets?
I met there. Marcus and all sorts of IMers. Really Cool was there, and all sorts of folks. So it was a lot of fun. Hopefully, shortly, we're going to have an announcement about a Majority Report show in the next couple of months. So
can't wait for that.
We will see. Which reminds me, after the show today, we got to talk about dates. Emma!
Yeah.
Vigeland is here, and...
It was a jump scare. Jeez. What?
Everything is... we're a little bit off balance today. I'm not going to lie.
Doesn't feel like Monday.
Yeah.
Kind of forgot it was Sunday show.
Right. We all forgot.
There you go. So,
What were you going to ask me?
Just,
Hi.
Hi. How you feeling? Hey.
I'm good. Huh? I'm actually okay. I thought it would be worse when I realized that I needed to leave immediately, not say goodbye to anybody, and go to sleep. I thought I would feel worse today, but I'm okay. I'm okay.
I had to do something like that too because I was getting a text from my kids were having a meltdown, so I had to rush back.
But gotcha.
It lasted for a while. They held out. So let's get right into it. We got a lot to talk about today. One of the things Janet Yellen has announced, at least, that there's not going to be a the most easiest and obvious solution to this farce that is the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling, raising the debt ceiling, is really something that should just be completely pro forma. The Congress has already authorized the spending and appropriated the money. And this is just basically saying now we have to cover our bill. But this remains for a bunch of different reasons, a almost an annual thing, particularly when the Republicans control the House and there's a Democratic president. Doesn't work that way when there's a Republican president and Democrats don't obviously hold it up when there's a Democratic president. What is going to come out of this? Undoubtedly, is going to be some type of deal because the administration doesn't seem to be giving itself any other option where they will do the hard job of looking at so-called entitlements. And what they're talking about are the two social insurance programs we have, the wildly popular social insurance programs of Social Security and Medicare. And we're already starting to see a new Simpson-Bowles committee floated around. We talked a little bit about that, I think, the other day with Perrine, what the last committee was. It was a joke. And the joke is on you. They want to cut Social Security. There's two things that have to that can happen right now with Social Security. Just by, for all intents and purposes, let's say that the Social Security Trust Fund runs out of money in 2033. It can change. It can be 2034. It can be 2031. But this is basically a rainy day fund, an excess amount of fund that was developed really back in 1982, I think it was, during the Reagan administration when Alan Greenspan and the Reagan administration and the Democrats realized that there was going to be a demographic bulge, the baby boomers. And how are we going to pay them out? So they raised the taxes. They developed this essentially, you know, excess fund for Social Security. That fund is going to run out in 2033. When it does, there will be automatic cuts to Social Security, about 23% cuts across the board in terms of benefits. This can be avoided by simply doing what was the original formulation of Social Security, and that is to raise the cap. Right now, the cap is at $160,000. The first $160,000 you earn is subject to the Social Security tax. If you don't earn that much, everything you earn is subject to the Social Security tax. If you make $200,000, if you make $500,000, if you make $750,000, $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $5 million, $10 million, on and on and on, none of that money except for the first $160,000 is subject to Social Security taxes. Your employer doesn't pay the 8% and you don't pay the 8% essentially to match it.
And given income inequality and how that's ballooned, you can see why that would be a problem.
Right, because there are more people who now, instead of like having 10 people who make $160,000, you have one person who makes $160,000 and then another person who makes $10 million.
Right.
And so only their first $160,000 is captured. That's a little bit of a simplistic way of showing it, but that's the dynamic. And where it used to be about 91%, 90% of all income was touched by that Social Security tax, now only about 81, 82% is. And so to rejigger that and get 90, 91%, you could also do 100%.
Yeah. Eliminate
you
the cap.
Eliminate the cap. End of story. And that tax just gets paid on every dollar. And why wouldn't it be?
And this happened to Medicare, right? In the 90s, the cap was eliminated, am I getting that right?
What happened with Medicare is that there is an additional sort of like side tax, if you will, on money that goes above the cap.
Gotcha.
So it's not the same payroll tax, but it's another one. And the ACA added a little one too. Here is Joe Manchin. And remember, take this with a grain of salt, because Joe Manchin at the beginning, if you remember, of the Build Back Better saga, said, well, I think $3.5 trillion's too little. I think we should be spending $4 trillion. And then, after everyone was lulled to sleep, he met with his people, and it came out like, we're not going to spend any of that money. So I'm not convinced that we're not seeing this here again. He comes out, the guy you would imagine who's going to be the strongest proponent for cuts to Social Security, comes out and says, I'm not for cuts to Social Security, which may just open that door to that new Simpson Bowles. But here he is.
Talk and look at the ways.
Well, let's talk about Social Security and Medicare. As part of these negotiations over the debt ceiling, you are suggesting a new committee to come up with ways to make Medicare and Social Security more financially
secured,
stable. I want to be clear there. Are you talking about any cuts
no
benefits?
Cuts. No cuts to anybody that's receiving their benefits. No adjustments to that. They've earned it. They've paid into it. Take that off.
Pause it. No cuts to anyone receiving their benefits.
Yep.
So a guy like me, who's not getting benefits for 7 years, maybe, I can get cuts. You can get cuts. So just be clear on what's going on here. He's not saying no cuts. He's saying no cuts to anybody right now.
Cuts
no
benefits.
No cuts to anybody that's receiving their benefits. No adjustments to that. They've earned it. They've paid into it. Take that off the table. But everyone's using that as a leverage.
Receiving their benefits now or at...
You want to look at everything humanly.
Is it now
possible,
or the future?
Well, you have to look at people that basically, where are they in their working age? What's going on here? But the bottom line is Social Security and Medicare basically is running out of cash because we stop at a certain level when people pay into FICA.
So you're open to cuts and benefits for future recipients?
I'm open to basically raising the easiest and quickest thing we can do is raise the cap. Everybody says, oh, that's a tax.
Raise the age?
No. Forget the age.
Okay.
At 150, I think it's 150, 154,000, you quit paying. So if you're getting a paycheck, now in West Virginia, in a state like mine, that the median income is much lower than that, they're paying 100% of the tax. In wealthier areas, they're paying a very small percentage of that tax.
Your colleague, Bernie Sanders, tweeted, the last thing we need is another commission to propose cuts to Social Security and Medicare.
I agree with him. Bernie and I agree on that. You don't need a committee to look at cuts, and that's what they're using and weaponizing it. Can't you look and find out in government where you can be more efficient, more basically prudent with the taxpayers' money, and quit wasting it, don't you think? And we all talk about waste, fraud, and abuse. That's an easy thing to do.
Well, can you pause it? Yeah, because this pairs with what he said, what we played on the Thursday show last week, where the entirety of like what this bipartisan commission that he's trying to put together is to look for fraud, which is an infinitesimal amount of the money that he calls waste in that fund. But if he wants to raise the cap, I'll take that 100%.
Yes. But I when I hear this, I hear a guy who's saying it's all on the table except for changing the age. And he's saying that maybe, okay, if you're 55 and you paid into it for the most of your life, then you won't get cuts. But if you're 45, we're going to cut. I mean, he's looking to cut.
That's what he means by efficiency. That's the language he's using.
And he's looking to cut. So, you know, this, the committee, if they set up a committee like this, it's going to be all hands on deck to fight this one in the same way that we fought Simpson Bowles, because it's garbage time, real garbage time. And, we're going to be talking later in the week about the change in the chief of staff, and that is not encouraging either. This guy, a corporate clown. But in just a moment, we'll be talking to Graham Raymond and Reuven Blau about their new book, The Rikers, An Oral History. In just a moment, we've got a couple of sponsors of today's program. This stuff is great. Apparently 1 in 3 Americans are sleep deprived, and for some folks, their sheets could be the problem. Why? Because your some sheets will trap your body heat, and it will not temperature regulate. This is a real problem for someone like myself, or it was until I got the Cozy Earth sheets. And I have to say, like, now I also got some of the loungewear.
Ah.
I never thought I would say
you never thought you'd be a loungewear guy.
I got like a, they call them joggers. They're like sweatpants.
Yep.
But I actually, you know, you can wear them out. Like, look at me, right?
They do call them joggers.
They call them joggers. I didn't realize it. Because I thought you had to jog, and I never jog.
They're basically sweatpants that have cuffs, right?
Yeah.
And so it looks a little more presentable.
It looks more presentable.
Yeah.
And they're great, and they're incredibly comfortable. But Cozy Earth has the softest, most luxurious, and best temperature-regulating sheets on the planet. It's like sleeping on a cloud, and because their sheets breathe, because they're made from... I don't know. It doesn't say it here, but I know that they're made from like bamboo. Yeah. Bamboo. Viscous or
viscous? It's viscous. I swear it's viscous.
Whatever. It doesn't matter. The point is it's made out of bamboo. I mean, it's incredibly soft. You wouldn't think when you hear bamboo, but it is incredibly soft.
And lightweight.
And they breathe.
Yeah.
It's cooler than cotton. So you never have to worry about hot flashes. It has thousands of 5-star reviews. And again, check out the comfy loungewear. Oh, and the socks. That's the other thing I got. Cozy Earth socks.
Oh, that's nice.
They're amazing. They're really amazing. They got a bath collection. I haven't gotten anything from that yet, but I'm thinking about it. That's the way I move, very slowly with these things. But
I told
started
you,
with
I
sheets.
Have the comforter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Folks, check this stuff out. Do not sleep on this. Well, actually, sleep on the sheets, but don't sleep on the other stuff. You can sleep in those, too, actually. They're incredibly comfortable. Cozy Earth sheets now come in 6 awesome colors and come packaged in a stylish, reusable Cozy Earth tote, which I have used. Check them out. Save 35% on Cozy Earth. Hurry. The offer ends soon. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority now to save 35%. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. CozyEarth.com/majority. I wish I knew this was coming down the pike, or I would have saved myself that 35% on the socks. Mm. That's all right. Okay, CozyEarth.com. I'm not mad. CozyEarth.com/majority. Check it out. Also, one of today's sponsors, the best tasting honey on the planet. And it comes from New Zealand. Yep. Apparently, there is a Manuka tea tree that you got bees will make honey from, I guess, the pollen from this Manuka tea tree. And the honey is called Manukura. And it is honestly the best tasting honey I have ever tasted. It tastes different than honey. I mean, it tastes like honey, but then it tastes different. It is much creamier. The texture is almost more like caramel. The taste is like not as like super sweet as honey,
mm-hmm.
but it's sweet, like almost like caramel. It really is amazing. It also has unique antioxidants and prebiotics. It has a natural antibacterial compound called MGO that only comes from the nectar of this tea tree. It contains nutrients that support optimal immune and digestive health. For the most part, I've just been like taking a shot of it when I want to have something sweet.
Hmm.
It's delicious. But you can add it to like your tea, your coffee, your yogurt, whatever, your salad, your ice cream. The caramel texture, it melts in your mouth. It is really like no honey you have ever tasted. It's crazy. And I've tried a bunch of different honey. Wildflower, clover, raw. I mean, I've never tasted honey like this that is so different and so delicious. Manukura Super Honey is available in a range of easy-to-use formats. They have squeeze bottles. They have compostable honey stick packs, so you can eat it straight or add it to your favorite food or beverage. If you head to manukura.com/majority, you're going to automatically get a free pack of honey sticks with your order. That's a $15 value. That's Manukora. Manukura.com/majority. Get a free pack of honey sticks with your order. It's called Honey with Superpowers for good reason. Get on it and try this delicious, creamy caramel honey. You won't look back with Manukura. And of course, that and all our links will be in the podcast and YouTube descriptions as well as on the website at majority.fm. All right, quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Graham Raymond and Reuven Blau. They have written a book, Rikers, An Oral History. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Graham Raymond, criminal justice reporter for the New York Daily News. Reuven Blau, senior reporter for The City, authors of Rikers, An Oral History. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. This is it's a really fascinating approach to writing something like this. You have essentially collected, as you know, basically quotes on a various a multitude of different aspects of life at Rikers from a multitude of different people. Graham, let's start with you. Tell us, like, just give us a sense of the range of people that you interviewed for this book.
Well, we interviewed more than 130 people. We wanted to put the voices of people who were either incarcerated there or worked there at the forefront. So there's retired correction officers. There are people who are incarcerated there. There are relatives of people who are incarcerated. We interviewed some commissioners, lawyers who dealt with legal cases that involved conditions and violence at Rikers. As we were trying to get as broad a cross-section as possible, so you know, you're hearing all these different themes, you're hearing different viewpoints, different experiences about the themes, and we wanted to be very intimate, down to the ground, down at ground level rather than 10,000 feet up.
I have to say, too, that there were moments that were just so, and I want to circle back to this, but sometimes it's really just shocking to hear a prisoner talk about an experience, and then a former not necessarily, I mean, some of the guards, they don't like to be called guards, but a former commissioner just basically like, yeah, no, that's what we wanted to do. I mean, something to that effect, like where the brutality just seemed to be, shocking. But Reuven, tell us, will you give us just some broad statistics for people about Rikers? I'm not sure that necessarily nationally everyone is aware of just what kind of place this is.
Yeah, absolutely. So just the geography itself, it's on the, you know, on the East River, there's one sort of public bus that takes you there. And there's one bridge that gets you there as well. Like the bus goes over this bridge and it's away from the courthouses in New York City. So, you know, that geography is one of the big issues that of the driving forces behind the kind of close Rikers plan as well. Currently there's about 6,000 people locked up there. The overwhelming majority is pretrial detainees. I think it's over 80%. And of that 80%, 50% of the population has diagnosed with some type of mental illness, including 16% with a serious mental illness.
Pretrial detainees, can you expand on that? Because I'm not sure, again, people nationally are aware of the fact that there are a lot of people housed in Rikers who have not been convicted of anything. And in fact, there are people who have died in Rikers prior to any kind of conviction or trial.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pretrial essentially is that, you know, they're held up there while their cases are pending and because they can't make bail. And there's a kind of a big conversation now in New York City about bail reform that was changed a couple of years ago. And, you know, many of the people there are there because, you know, some, not necessarily as much as it used to be with small amounts of bail, but there are definitely people there who have, you know, have issues with court appearances. And yeah, I mean, just overwhelming the number of people have not been convicted of a crime. And the people who do stay there, the maximum stay is supposed to be a year. Now that actually is the stay has gone up way up recently because a lot of these cases are the trials or the court hearings are kind of getting dragged out for kind of a multitude of reasons. But ultimately, yeah, it's people who overwhelmingly who have not been, you know, convicted. And you referenced the deaths last year. There was 19, right, Graham? I think it was 19, which is the highest rate in the last, I think, two or three decades of people who passed away. And the overwhelming number of those had never been convicted of a crime. In that moment, I mean.
And I want to circle back on that number of deaths, too, because the number of people at Rikers now seems to be at more or less an all-time low. Their budget seems to be at an all-time high. And yet, I mean, presumably having deaths at the prison is a one sign of a massive failure. But Graham, just to flesh this out a little bit more, when we say that, you know, people are there awaiting trial, like, what are the numbers there? I mean, you're only supposed to be there for a year, which seems to be a long time, awaiting trial. But like, what is the average stay? Like, if I'm awaiting trial and I don't have the money for bail, how many times do I go back? And you talk about this, actually, I guess it's called the bullpen theory or bullpen therapy. Will you tell us what the bullpen therapy is? And sort of like give us the numbers of just how many people are there for how long? Because once we start talking about the conditions there, I mean, it is really just, it's like medieval on some level.
Sure. The average stay, the average pretrial stay these days, the last number we saw was it's over 100 days. So someone gets arrested, they're staying there for an extraordinarily long time. And there are people there who are there for a year pretrial, 2 years pretrial, 3 years, 4 years. There's one guy who's been there for 8 years awaiting trial.
How can that be legal? I mean, how can that be constitutional that somebody's in jail for 8 years without having been convicted of a crime?
It's extraordinary. There's a young man in the book. He went in at 19 and his case finally got resolved he was 24. That was all pretrial detention. When he finally got sentenced, he was sentenced to 3 weeks in state prison. So he did 5 years pretrial to get 3 weeks in state prison. There's a lot of reasons that the case of the man who's in there for 8 years, there's a lot of complicated reasons, but for people who've been there for 3 years, it's just the general bureaucratic situation in New York City. The pandemic, the slowdown, and the backlog that was created by the pandemic contributed to that. But even in regular times, you have people going for court appearances 8, 10, 9, 10, 11, 12 times over the course of a year and a half, 2 years, and nothing happens in their case. And those court appearances, what you're referring to as bullpen therapy, where you're going back and forth from the island to the courthouse and back with nothing happening in your case, it can become so debilitating that people plead guilty just to get out of the situation. And that gives prosecutors, whether intentional or not, it gives them leverage. If you're being held in jail, you're more likely to want to get your case resolved however you can, rather than if you're out on bail, when people are more likely to fight their cases if they're out on bail.
And particularly this jail. I mean, this is. But Ruven, what is your sense as to how much of a strategy this is by prosecutors? And maybe not in each individual case, but in the aggregate, one of the mechanisms that we use. I'm just hypothesizing. One of the mechanisms we use as a prosecutor to try less cases and to get more guilty pleas is just to keep making them go back and forth between Rikers. So people know Rikers is an island, and it is an all day affair. We hear stories in the book that you miss dinner, but it's not. I mean, dinner doesn't sound like something that you necessarily want, but it's an exhausting affair. And to leave and then go back into Rikers sounds like, literally, like entering into a nightmare each time. I mean, it must be. As we talk more about it, we'll hear. But how much of this do you think is a general, overall strategy in which to deal with cases?
We interview people and former detainees, and one of the things we asked them was like, "What was the worst part of the experience?" Or like, And for me, the answer I thought would be the violence, or multiple of other, a ton of other possibilities. But I interviewed somebody, his name is Paul Wooster, for the book, and he said the worst part was this bullpen therapy, this cycle of back and forth, and just how exhausting and draining it is. And it just seems so baked into the system, like into the New York City kind of criminal justice system that exists, that it's just like they just kind of almost kind of force people to plead their cases out because they just don't want to go back and forth. And part of the challenge is also when you go back and forth is you're putting these bullpens with different people. Some people, if you're like, warring gangs are sometimes put into the system, and there's a lot of violence that just kind of happens in these bullpens themselves. And frequently, like I talked to Michael Jacobson, who's a former commissioner, Corrections Department commissioner, and he told me that they would struggle in the 90s when the population was about 20,000, and now it's about, closer to 6,000. But he said that they literally would miss the court. Like they would get them, they couldn't get them there by 9 a.m. So they'd wake them up at 3-4 in the morning. By the time they got them out on the vans, they would miss the date. They would miss the actual hearing itself at 9 a.m. So it's just one of these things that he said was struggling with when he was there in the 90s. And we interviewed multiple commissioners, and every single one of them has said, this has been an issue that we have battled forever.
So now, why is that 6-hour lag? It's because this is not just like, hey, hop in an Uber, head down to the court. It's they're in chains. They have to go through a process in which they sort of like outtake and intake and get into the van. I mean, what are all the different, what makes it, why is it so long to do that transfer?
I mean, also like just for the national audience, but like New York City's busy, it's a busy place and there's traffic, like going into Manhattan, going into the Bronx, going to the Queens, like, anyone who's driven in any of these places during rush hour, will tell you, you end up sitting for a while. So there's that part of it, but it's also just the kind of the bureaucracy that just the slow, the paperwork, the getting the people in the right vans at the right place, the right time. It's just the sheer number of doing it, getting the people, for the right dates. It's just, there's constant mess ups.
Graham, let's talk about the sort of the history of Rikers before we get into things like solitary too, which is
it's torture.
It's torture, but just give us a historical context. So we've heard that like there's been far more prisoners there at any given time. There's also been the most well funded jail in the country. It doesn't sound like that when you start to hear about what's going on there, but will you just give us some of that history and then like maybe why it could be so rat infested, so dilapidated, why there can be 19 deaths there if it is being so well funded?
It's a very good question. It's a question that I struggle with quite a bit. Why that is. Just going backwards, Rikers started out, it was a farm. It was bought by the city in the 1880s for $180,000, which is about $5 million today. It was used first for debtors' prisons, and there was also a juvenile detention center, a home for wayward boys, basically. But it was also a huge garbage dump with an enormous number of rats, and the garbage fires could be seen from the Upper East Side in Manhattan and the South Bronx. The first real jail that we considered a jail, the New York Times said it would correct the evils of the past. That was in 1930. It was built between 27 and 32. And basically the city made a decision that we're going to put our jails out of sight, out of mind. We're just going to ship it to this island. We're going to make the island hard to get to. This was the decision that set the framework for the situation we're in today. The second really important historical part is in 1979 they were going to turn Rikers into a state prison facility only, with borough jails for the pretrial detainees. Instead, what happened was they ditched that plan, and then crack descended on the city, and they went on a prison building spree. They built three more jails on Rikers. And the population zoomed up to over 20,000. So now we have fewer than 6,000 people there, but we're seeing the same conditions problems. There's been no peace dividend for the decline in the population, there was a crisis that started in the jails a year ago over conditions, and people sitting in intake, jammed into cells for days, lying in their own urine. and these like urine-soaked intake cells. And it really is extraordinary when you consider it's $500,000 a year to house one detainee. That's how much the city is spending.
Where is that? I mean, it sort of feels like some of that $500,000 is ending up in some people's pockets that, you know, like it's hard to sort of square that dollar figure with what we know and what you guys have reported on in terms of that facility. Like, where do you have, I imagine it's speculation on some level, but do you have ideas as to where some of that money might be going?
I mean, a lot of it goes to, you know, the kind of the workforce, and the union kind of plays, is kind of a big part of this conversation about Rikers, Rikers reform, and the history of Rikers. You know, the staffing levels are incredibly generous. Like it's almost like a 1-to-1, very close to kind of a 1-to-1 ratio, which is better than anywhere in the rest of the country. But the problem is that they don't, a lot of the officers don't want to work like in the actual jails themselves. And they've been assigned to other areas like transportation, you know, like the central office and all these other sort of areas where they found roles for officers. So there's this a real challenge of just actually staffing the place properly. And, you know, it costs a lot of money. Like on any given day, the last year or two, they've had this staffing crisis where there's been over 1,000 officers who were either out sick or just they are, you know, different areas outside the jails. They have the union has negotiated something called unlimited sick leave, which was really designed by for officers who get injured on the job to kind of take however much time they need to kind of, you know, to get better, to heal. But the abuses are you know, after COVID, you know, COVID kind of hit and there's they have a system where they can kind of literally go to your house and check to make sure you're home and, you know, not out partying. And they just couldn't keep up with the number of people who are out. And they just really just kind of had this really kind of explosion of absenteeism.
There's a real, I'll just add to that. There's a real disconnect. The jail for young men, 18 to 20, is 60 years old. It was built in 1972 and it's falling apart. Part of that jail is made up of modular units, which were supposed to be temporary with a 5-year shelf life. We're going on close to 30 years that those things have been used. And, you know, that population of young men, that's the most vulnerable. That's the most, the population that you theoretically can get to. And, you know, and they're in probably one of the worst jails. So there's just a major disconnect in seems to me in the priorities of the system.
I mean, well, it seems like the cruelty is the point, to be real. I mean, there's also this major disconnect in the fact that there's all this money available, clearly, right? And on one side of the equation. And then on the other side, you talk about how this initially began as a debtor's prison. In many ways, that legacy continues because it's a bit of a different gradation. But what this is about is that for pretrial detention in particular, these are people that cannot afford to walk free. And so they are forced into these conditions when clearly we have systems that could be in place to monitor them and to use that money if they're worried about flight risks or something, to monitor them and not put them in a system that could literally kill them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a real subjective, you know, government in some ways has control over the population. During the pandemic, the population got down below 4,000, a number that people thought would never happen in, you know, in the next 200 years would never happen. So, you know, there was something driving it. Well, you know, the pandemic was driving those releases. So just, you know, a lot of it is the system. You know, if there's a perception of a crime spike, the system leans toward locking people up, even though the whole point of jail is just to make sure people appear to come to their court appearances. But I think that, you know, and this is maybe an American, you know, in some respects an American thing, that the jail, even pretrial detention, is supposed to be punitive in some way. And, you know, and that's one of the things that I think comes up in the book repeatedly is that very question, that fundamental question about what do we really want out of our jails?
Ruvane, it feels like the that question persists because it is just there's no political value in expending any resources on answering it.
There's this great quote in the book from Marty Horn, who's also one of the former commissioners. He says, like, no mayor has ever gone on to sort of national prominence by how he's run the jails. And, you know, it really resonated with me, especially in kind of covering this and the frustration I've had sometimes. And, you know, when we highlight some of these kind of awful incidents, you know, how they just sometimes doesn't really get a lot of attention beyond just sort of the day of story and that's it. You know, yeah, I mean, it really is just sort of the system that exists, this muscle that exists in New York City, where, you know, this is how we have it set up. You know, one of the things, you know, we talked about is the 19 deaths, and some of those people were homeless, like, you know, and had nowhere to go. And you know, we're not addressing that. You know, many of them suffer from kind of serious mental illness. One of them was in a hospital trying to get treatment, and he was in a waiting room, and he was acting out because he was having kind of a mental health crisis. And instead of, you know, sending him to a doctor at the hospital, they arrested him, and he ended up taking his own life a few months later after being moved to sort of a mental observation unit. So yeah, I mean, that's just, this is how the city works.
Let's talk about that. The number of, or the percentage of people in there that you state have some mental health issue. Like, can you flesh that out for us? I've seen numbers ranging from 40 to 60%. I mean, how is that assessed? And like, what, have we always as a city always said the first destination is to go to Rikers in that instance? I mean, how can we know that there's that many percentage of people with mental health issues and then just be like, and it doesn't in any way implicate or affect what we do with these folks?
I mean, I think, you know, there's been kind of over time, right? Like, there's been a movement to sort of, you know, kind of deinstitutionalize people with mental health issues. But at the same time, there was supposed to be sort of federal funding for kind of smaller group homes or areas that were kind of more intensive treatment. And that has, you know, as years have gone on, it has not materialized. And also sort of mental health beds in hospitals has shrunk drastically, dramatically over the last 10 to 20 years in New York City. So what you're seeing is, yeah, many of these people who are kind of experiencing these kind of mental health crises end up in Rikers. And it's really like just the absolute worst place for them because they struggle with just basic following rules. If they don't understand the rules, and frequently, you know, they're the ones who end up in solitary. And that just kind of furthers, you know, their kind of mental health decompensation. They are diagnosed. There's clinicians or mental health clinicians. We've interviewed several for the book. And one of them told this kind of dramatic story about how there was this guy there who would go around calling her cupcake gerbil face, you know, like he just did not understand like where he even was. And he would physically harm himself, and they would try to bring, she was kind of had a connection with him, and they would try to bring her to him to kind of get him to stop because, you know, they had this sort of connection. There's another story in the book where I interviewed a chaplain, and he was doing kind of Friday morning services, like Shabbat services. They were doing, you know, they were singing. And he did this, you know, for weeks in a row and no problems. And suddenly one week, some guy in the front row comes up and just out of nowhere hits him in the face. Just out of nowhere, a complete mental sort of breakdown.
Let's talk about solitary. Graham, like how widely and extensively is solitary used? Like for what purpose? I mean, this is ostensibly just a place where people are waiting for a trial. Why is there even like a solitary, I don't know, program?
Well, it depends on who you ask, and it depends on what language you use. There's a struggle now over what is, the correction department will tell you, we don't have solitary confinement. We don't have punitive segregation. We don't separate people. But at the same time, we've learned that in fact they have done that. They just recently they took a bunch of young men out of the jail I mentioned earlier, and they put them in isolation cells in a different jail because they had been acting out and, you know, perceived to have been causing trouble. You know, this is a really broad topic, but there used to be a unit called the BING, the Central Punitive Segregation Unit, where people were sent initially separating out people who cause violence in the jails was the idea, right?
Right. I mean, obviously, if somebody is attacking other prisoners, you want to separate them. Or if they are maybe, I guess, particularly like being targeted, maybe you want to separate them.
Correct. But that would be, yeah, that would be like administrative segregation, separate someone out for their own protection. But what happened was, you know, the initial idea of separating because they were being violent became the categories of why you separate someone become larger and larger and larger and larger. And so you could be separated for all kinds of reasons. Romaine interviewed somebody who was put in solitary confinement for possession of aspirin,
Tylenol, the makeup.
Yeah. You know, and so if you take it's. You take somebody.
That was Kuby. Kuby had that client, right? Yeah. Okay. Ron Kuby.
Yeah.
You take somebody, particularly with mental illness, you know, who's mentally ill, and you put them. You can't control them, so you put them in solitary confinement. It only exacerbates the situation. There's an anecdote in the book about a tour of the jails and a tour of a solitary confinement area by this environmental specialist, and he comes across a man in a cell who's clearly decompensating. The cell is over 100 degrees, which is a violation of the law. You can't, there's a certain limit on how hot a cell can be before you have to air condition it. And there's a generator right outside this man's window, which is belting out a very high decibel noise on a constant basis. It's just running constantly. You know, talk about a series of conditions designed to make this guy totally go over the deep end.
I mean, just the idea of if you are, I mean, putting aside the ridiculousness of punishing someone because they have Tylenol in their possession and maybe some makeup, the fact that you are punishing someone and putting them into solitary confinement, it shows that it's not being used for the protection of other prisoners. It is being used to punish people. And it's just simply not their mandate to do that at Rikers. And the problem is that there doesn't, I mean, I guess this is sort of throughout the book. There's just no political will by anybody or political power to the extent that, you know, I guess, legal, lawyers who are defending people, there's no power or will to fix any of this stuff.
I mean, I think that's one of the things we tried to highlight in the book with this story is like, you know, we went by topic and what we're hearing is just even from like just different eras, like different, you know, decades was like the same problems kept coming up and over and again. One of the issues we highlighted was just the record keeping. And, you know, Graham and I, like in our kind of day jobs have reported how, you know, they've done these kind of individual scandals of like them kind of fudging numbers or trying to like kind of, you know, manipulate the figures. And we interviewed people in, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s and aughts who like, and they all had kind of different stories about how this was going on. And to this day, they actually use something called logbooks where they physically just kind of write in kind of basic incidents. They don't have like a computer system to record kind of the day-to-day happenings in the jail. And that's, again, by design, because they can kind of manipulate that.
Has there ever been an attempt by, let's say, a prisoner or just maybe, I guess, just out of the DOJ for feds to come in and say, this is inhumane treatment. Like, this is what's going on here is unconstitutional, that you can't detain people for 8 years. When they haven't been convicted of a crime. You can't, I mean, I don't, it seems to me ridiculous that you can detain anybody for a year. We have a right to a speedy trial. And have the feds come in? Have there been any attempt to sort of like get the prison shut down based upon some type of federal action?
Sure. I mean, I'll take part of it and removing the part of it. Yeah, I mean, there's been a series of class actions going back to the early 70s. The system is very stubborn. it resists change in a major way. And the feds did come in. There was a multi-year investigation that led in 2015 to a consent decree against the city of New York because violence was so out of control. And that brought a monitor, a federal monitor, who's been on the job for 7 years. The federal monitor has issued one report after another that is highly critical of how the system operates in every possible way you can imagine. And still, you know, we're not seeing the results of all of that work.
There's actually three other monitors that have been in place, including one for conditions, one for I think the release of, like, you know, how they handle the release of mentally ill, and I forget the third one. But and this is some of them have
juvenile,
right, for the juveniles, right? Yeah, thank you. So I mean, these monitors essentially have been in place for a long time. They, you know, to some degree have made, you know, there have been improvements, but it hasn't changed enough for the, you know, the courts to say, okay, you know, we don't need this oversight anymore. And now there's a tremendous push to have the federal judge overseeing kind of the juveniles to appoint something called a receiver. And the receiver, it's a kind of a very unique situation. There's one in California. There's only a few others in charge of kind of jail systems. And the one in California is just in charge of kind of the medical. There was one in Cook County, Illinois, that was in charge of the kind of the juveniles. And it would essentially be a person the judge decides who could run the jail and would have the ability to change any of the rules, like any of the union contract would kind of essentially be the fair game and kind of just start almost fresh and say, like, if you have the opportunity, like from scratch, how would you run this facility? And, you know, just kind of come at it from a totally new perspective. And the argument is in support of it is just kind of take the politics out of it. I mean, ultimately, the receiver would likely need to work with the unions and the city, you know, as far as financing goes, as far as rules go. You need to get buy-in from the, you know, people working there and, you know, the people overseeing the jail. But it would be this, you know, this incredible kind of change. And the people who support the receiver have said, look, you know, there have been commissioners over the last 20, 30 years who have come in and they've all been well-intentioned. They've all said, I want to change this. I want to make this work and I want to improve this. And some of them have had incredible knowledge and insight in how to run jails. And none of them have been successful. And that's why they're saying we need a receiver who can kind of start from scratch and has more power than a traditional city correction commissioner.
Where are we on the efforts to close it? Because I know that, like, the idea was that if it gets below 4,000 or maybe it was 3,000, then the city can close it and essentially disperse the jails around the city. Where are we on that, and what was the plan?
The plan was to get to build four new borough-based jails with a total capacity of about 3,300. The current jail population is just under 6,000, and the city is floating the idea that it's by the end of this year it's going to be above 7,000. Which will make it, you know, difficult to close. They're not really putting any data behind that estimate. It just seems to be, so far we haven't seen, like, what that estimate is based on. So you have there's an issue there with the population, and it's kind of what we're seeing is sort of a convergence of two big issues of closing Rikers and the backlash against bail reform. So now, the idea, since that crime has spiked, somehow should negate a plan to close Rikers, and that, you know, there's a perception that's being floated that things are so out of control that the jail population is almost certain to increase. When really, you know, it's possible to get the jail population down. Now, the question is, can they do it by 2027? And that becomes then a discussion about the logistics of construction and design and funding and all of that. And it could very well possibly be that the plan will be somehow delayed.
But I mean, without bail reform, this would just disperse some of the same issues, I'd imagine, that you guys you wrote about. I mean, some of the interviews you do with, say, you did with corrections officers, where they just talk about how they beat up a prisoner for 4 hours because of disrespect or something like that. I mean, isn't that just kind of endemic to the way that we imprison people, like, largely in this country, systemically, as opposed to, I mean, Rikers exacerbates it, of course, but isn't there a larger conversation that's necessary first, a larger change that's necessary first, before before there the breaking up of Rikers would make that much of a difference?
I don't think you can read the book. I mean, I think people should read the book and come to their conclusions. Everyone's going to bring their own lens to it, but you know, the legacy of decades, you know, of what's happening right there's too, from the voices of the people who lived it. I mean, you know, you'll hear from the officers themselves, the retired officers, some of the same kinds of things about the conditions, about the way the system operated, about, you know, the pointlessness of just putting people through over and over again on low-level arrests, the failures of the system to handle the mentally ill. The officers are almost all of them we talked to said, you know, it's completely unfair to put us in charge of somebody who has severe psychiatric issues because we're not trained for it. They're simply not trained for it. And you know, so overall, you know, I think that the book offers the opportunity for people to think about really what they want out of their jails. I mean, you know, all over the country.
Well, Graham Raymond, criminal justice reporter for the New York Daily News, and Ruvane Blau, senior reporter for The City. The book is Rikers, an Oral History. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. It's an important piece of work to hear these voices from over the course of decades in many respects in terms of their experience at Rikers. And just it really is just an incredible stain on our society, that institution. And hopefully more people will engage with it. But thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. We will head into the fun half. We've got a guest. We'll bring him in to the studio. Yeah, bring him in.
Lighten things up after that interview.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Some of these things. There was one guard who was recounting how he just beat the hell out of a prisoner and then got too tired and then came in and beat the hell out of him again. Really nuts. Wow, these guys are coming in with t-shirts.
Look at that.
Yeah, there we go. All right, well, we'll bring him on. We have a special guest that Willie will say hello to when we get into the fun half, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe we can get our first in-person farm report. All right. We're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. And you allow the show to survive and thrive. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Check out the AM Quickie, amquickie.com. A lot of people starting to sign up for the daily email blast in your box. $2 gets you every single day. You can also just check it out and get the free version. But check it out. And Emma, tough weekend.
Yeah. We won't be talking about that at all. Yes, we will. We will be talking about a wild divisional weekend, maybe some fun Skip Bayless content as well. He really never stops bringing the content. YouTube.com/ESPN show, 4 p.m. today.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leck media?
Yeah, David and I will have a show tomorrow night, having Andrew Perez of The Lever talk about Pfizer and Buttigieg and some other stuff that he's been covering over there. So look forward to that.
All right, quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
You breathe that, DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation,
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on! Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy.